Welcome to the Save the Earth podcast, bringing together UConn activists and experts to discuss different ways of thinking about the climate crisis and looking for next steps. This is episode 3, Human Rights and Imperialism, and I'm the host, Ben Aldi. Hello and welcome to the Save the Earth podcast. My name is Ben Aldi.
And I'm Monet Paredes.
And we're accompanied by UConn Associate Professor in the Department of Political Science and co-director of the research program on economic and social rights at the Human Rights Institute. This is Professor Cashmore. Professor, how are you doing today?
Good. And great to be with you guys, Ben and Monet. Wonderful to be talking about these important issues.
Yes, you as well.
Yeah, thank you so much for being here. Today we're just going to be talking about, you know, a few different issues that people don't always recognize are connected, but your research has shown that they are very much connected. It's climate change, human rights, and imperialism. So we can just start with this introduction question. What motivates your work on climate governance and climate justice?
Right, so thanks again. Really appreciate this opportunity to talk to you and share some of the work that we've been doing at UConn and Human Rights Institute and within my research group. Just to give you a little bit of background, before I came back to academia for my graduate studies, I had a first career in international development, where I worked at different scales, from grassroots, what President Obama used to call community organizing, to regional level programmatic stuff. If we think about climate change and its root causes, the root causes of climate change are in particular kinds of particular models of development, right? So it's energy intensive, fossil fuel dependent, extractive economy dependent, consumption oriented, thinking about development.
Right.
But there is another large part of the world's population, and some would argue even 2/3 of the world's population, who are not really served by this particular model of development.
Mm-hmm.
So even within poor countries, this model does serve a small elite group, but for majority of population, they pretty much live on daily wages, subsistence kind of economies, and they don't really benefit from this particular model of development. So at the heart of it, the ongoing climate crisis is also a development crisis in the sense that it is a result of skewed priorities of development that powerful governments and market actors have promoted at the cost of the welfare of a majority of the world's population.
Right.
And so in that sense, there's a great deal of connection between development and climate crisis and attempts to respond to climate crisis. And my history and my ongoing work fits right in there. So I thought it was a good idea to focus my work on that particular area of research and scholarship.
Awesome, great to hear. So Ben mentioned we want to talk about, like we said, human rights in relation to climate justice and imperialism. And we know that like most listeners probably already know what climate change is and what human rights are, but don't always know how they connect and how imperialism plays a role in that. Do you want to talk about like generally what imperialism is and why we talk about it when talking about the climate crisis?
So, to use a very simple sort of common sense definition of imperialism, imperialism is basically a particular country or a particular group of people extending their power beyond their own political jurisdiction, right? So when you try to wield power in places where you shouldn't actually have power, if we were living in a world that was equal and democratic, that's sort of, in a nutshell, that's imperialism, right? There's also, it's important to remember that imperialism builds on the real history of colonialism. And the processes of colonization are often talked about as the dominance of European powers over non-European countries in Africa, Asia, and in some extent Latin America. But it's equally important to remember that colonization also created a section of domestic elites who also got sort of who collaborated with the colonial powers, right? And that's why colonialism was so successful. And it continues to, even in the post-colonial world, you see sort of domestic relations that are sort of neo-colonial relations, right? So domestic elites control a majority of populations. And so it's sum total of those colonial, imperial, and neo-imperial domestic power relations and power asymmetries that we are talking about when we think about the connection between climate change and human rights. Right? There's the climate change has been caused by that particular model of development that I referred to earlier. And that model of energy intensive, extractive economy based, consumption oriented model of development serves this small elite in global north and some in global south, which were put up by the processes of colonialism, imperialism, and so forth. And they hold power in social, economic, political affairs. Now, because this elite was served by this model of development, they continued to push for this model, even though we have known since the late 60s, right? The most recent files that have been put out in the public domain in the context of the lawsuits that have been brought about by the states of New York, Massachusetts, and Connecticut against ExxonMobil and some of the other fossil fuel corporations. There are documents in the public domain which show that fossil fuel corporations and top political leadership here in the US and in European countries, they've known about the devastating impacts of fossil fuel economy since the late 60s at least. Right. So, and during that time, there's been a dozens of social scientists, activists, and scholar activists who've been making these arguments about the futility of this extractive economy-oriented model and the fact that it was going to lead to a greater and greater exploitation of a majority of the world's population. But those warnings were not heeded, and they could not be incorporated into our political and policy processes because these processes are controlled by this small elite that we are talking about. So in a sense, climate crisis is a direct result of this, you know, sort of day-to-day functioning of imperial, neo-colonial power relations within societies and across societies. And so there's a direct connection between these processes and the causes of climate crisis. Now, even in the midst of climate crisis, we know that governments are not doing enough, partly because those people who are affected by climate crisis don't have the political power and the economic power to change things so rapidly, right? So it's the ongoing power imbalances that explain both the climate crisis as well as the ongoing failures to respond to climate crisis, which produce human rights implications. And about those, we can talk about separately in next set of questions.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think a lot of people hear like colonialism and like imperialism and they're like, oh yeah, like that's a thing of the past, but it really is having implications today that if you're living in your bubble, you're not paying attention to.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, that's why we do what we do, trying to raise the power of people who typically aren't in those elites that have all that power. But we know that, kind of moving on, we know that as a professor, you teach UConn students about the many different facets of climate justice, like what you're talking about and the ways of approaching it. So is there a specific example that you can speak to and how we can look at it through the lens of climate justice?
Sure. So, you know, again, sort of to talk about some of the basic ideas about how climate crisis produces human rights violations. So the first, you know, the easiest way to think about this relationship between climate crisis and human rights is to first understand that human rights is not just about war crimes and, you know, torture. I mean, all of those are important issues that human rights scholars and activists have fought for and have, you know, addressed. But human rights are also about what are referred to as social and economic rights. So right to food, right to water, right to energy, and right to education, and those kinds of rights, right? So these are collectively referred to as social and economic rights within the broader umbrella of human rights. And so there are direct connections between the changes that are happening in climate patterns and you know, seasonal changes in temperatures and moisture and rainfall, sea level rise, all of these impacts of climate change, you know, for a majority of us here in Global North, you know, our food is actually not dependent on what happens to the rainfall tomorrow, right? Because we are connected to a market where, you know, we don't have to worry about who bears the risk of food production in the midst of an ongoing climate crisis or in the midst of, say, an ongoing COVID crisis, right? We are pretty much insulated against that because our food comes from markets and we have the capacity to pay. As long as we pay, we'll keep getting our food from somewhere. But that's not the case for a large majority of world's population who are dependent directly on natural resources of fisheries, of forest-dependent foods, of, you know, rain-fed subsistence, local agriculture. So, you know, there are large majority of world's farmers who produce their own food. And so if they, if, you know, if they were expecting the monsoons in a particular country to come at a particular time with a particular intensity and particular level of moisture that is good for their crops, if there are drastic changes in those patterns, they lose their food crop for a year or two, right? And so those are the people whose, you know, ability to thrive and prosper as human being has already been undermined because of the ongoing climate crisis. So when in 2018, for example, when Houston happened, and we were all heartbroken, you know, remember all those images that we saw across the electronic and print media for a couple of weeks. It was pretty bad to take, right? 60 people died in the Hurricane Harvey. You know, it was a hurricane, and then it became a storm, I think. 60 people died, but around that same time, 1,400 people died in a small part of South Asia, which is, you know, parts of North India, Bangladesh, and Nepal. Had 1,400 people die because of floods. And during the same months, other parts of India were actually experiencing drought so that farmers were not able to grow their crops. And 40 million people around that same time, 40 million people had their lives disrupted by these floods, which are directly linked to the changing frequency, intensity, and timing of the rainfall in that part of the world. And tens of millions of, or hundreds of thousands, if not millions of school students, they couldn't go to school for 2 weeks because of those floods, right? So there are all kinds of impacts that are already happening in people's day-to-day lives because one, the intensity of impacts is so much that even if governments were trying to do their best, they find it hard to adapt to these kinds of changes. And second, you know, people are too poor to protect themselves against the impacts of floods and hurricanes and, you know, on and droughts and so forth. So food, energy, water are already being interfered directly by the ongoing climate crisis. And these people are being deprived of their human rights to food, energy, and water because of the climate crisis, in which they have no role to play, actually. They've never actually contributed even a thinnest possible slice of greenhouse gases to the overall accumulation of greenhouse gases that has contributed to climate change. Right? So that's the direct example of what we refer to as climate injustice, right, where the people who did not actually create climate crisis. And in fact, you know, if we, and I've been sort of working on this other argument where I show how the poorest people of the earth have been subsidizing the environmental goods and environmental services for the rich people. Because if poor people adopt the kind of agricultural practices that are good for the storing of carbon in soil, right? We are continuing to drive our SUVs and we, you know, emit all those greenhouse gases. They are being absorbed by the agricultural practices of poor people. So they are subsidizing our wasteful lifestyles.
Wow.
There are indigenous people in Latin America, indigenous people in Africa and India and Asia at large, who've been protecting their forest, and those forests absorb our greenhouse gases. So these are all the examples of the ways in which poor people have subsidized our wasteful lifestyles. And but they are the ones who are the first ones to pay the prices of price of climate crisis and the cost of climate crisis. And so these are, you know, I mean, there is not even a complicated rocket science issue here. It's in fact, at one level, it's pretty simple. And it's important that more and more people sort of know about this and talk about these issues.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What do you think would be, like, in your opinion, like, the first steps to change that? I think it comes from the elites, like, taking notice, or you think they're not even, like, noticing that? Or what do you think would be, like, the first, like, step from where we are right now?
Right. I think increasingly there's quite a bit of discussion, and there are people like me who are sort of, you know, pestering the community of environmentalists and academics nonstop, reminding that these are the issues that we should be talking about. So, but, you know, on a more serious note, there is quite a bit of recognition of the problem, and there is a discussion of these things. But, and here I think in the email exchanges that we had, you know, I think one of you mentioned what can we do in particular sitting here in the US, sort of, you know, addressing these problems. We, you know, so the first thing that we should make note of, and which we should bring into our discussion, is that for a very long time, we have created this narrative of American exceptionalism, right? And so, you know, many people even today believe that, I mean, you know, we tend to write off President Trump's tenure as a sort of exception, as a sort of, you know, as a sort of sorry chapter that we would rather forget, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm speaking here not as a citizen, not as a political person, but as an academic who studies environmental policy and climate policy. So in that context, you know, I think this last 4 years have been quite a disappointment, to say the least. Mm-hmm. But other than that, you know, I think a large majority of people in US still believe that America is the leader when it comes to environmental protection in the world. That's actually far from true. America lost its leadership of the climate movement and global environmental movement when, in I think in 1996 or 97, we withdrew from the Kyoto Protocol, which was the precursor to the Paris Agreement. And so, you know, so between 95 and so this is a quarter century of American laggardism, so as to say. We have been a laggard, you know, a country that has been lagging behind Europe and even Canada and many other countries in terms of climate action and environmental action. So first of all, it's important to remember that we used to be a global environmental leader in some ways, you know, in the 80s and in even in until about maybe early 90s, I would say. So it's important to remember and recover that history, both for our own sake, but also for the sake of global climate action, because we have been a big contributor to the accumulated stock of greenhouse gases. And if we have this recognition within the domestic political debates here, it's more likely that our politicians will be motivated to act, right? And then let me also quickly clarify that, you know, there's quite a bit of discussion about the increasing emissions from India and China. Whenever you hear that, you know, India and China are rapidly increasing their emissions and they're becoming number two and number three countries in terms of emissions, that is a reference to annual emissions, which are happening now. Climate crisis that we are in the middle of now, that crisis has been caused by the accumulated greenhouse gases that have been, you know, been emitted since the Industrial Revolution of 18, you know, beginning with the 1860 and so forth. And that accumulated stock of greenhouse gases, US contributes about 25% or something like that. So if we account for the global north, which, you know, earlier we used to call them developed countries or economically developed countries, they have contributed about 65% to 70% of the entire accumulation of greenhouse gases, even though they are a very small proportion of global population.
Right.
So I think a greater awareness of our contribution to climate crisis, while remembering that US used to be a pioneer in some kinds of environmental policies in the 70s and 80s, both of those factors are an important, you know, they should become part of our conversation.
Yes. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I, in my understanding, people often look at like China's and India's rise in their greenhouse emissions, but per capita, it's actually the US who's producing like much more for the amount of people we have.
That's correct, right? So there's an issue of per capita, because, so, you know, I think many years ago, I did a back of the envelope calculation, and the ratio between land and people between, say, India and US was about 1 to 20 or 21, something like that. So, you know, in the same piece of land where you find one person here in the US, you will have to accommodate 20 or 21 people in India. So you know, if we look at energy consumption between, say, per capita energy consumption in parts of Africa, you know, I think it's Ghana or Nigeria. I was looking at one of those figures earlier today, and that ratio is about 80 times, I think, per capita. A US citizen consumes 80 times more than per capita in one of those countries. But remember, even per capita is actually a misleading indicator, because when we do per capita computations here in the US, there are vast inequalities between people who own, you know, their private planes and who fly from one town to another in their helicopter or something, versus people who find it difficult to heat their homes during the winter months, right? Mm-hmm. And so if you actually account for inequalities both within the global north and inequalities within global south, I mean, those computations are actually, you know, they'll be out of roof. We don't even have the right kind of imagination to think about what those inequalities look like, right? Because one of the sort of the downsides of inequality, especially here in the US, so there have been surveys where people go and ask, average Americans about, you know, where do they belong in the economic ladder. I think much larger proportion of US population actually believes that they are in, they belong in the middle class. But we, if we actually look at the actual economic indicators of what should be defined as middle class, that middle class has been shrinking rapidly over past 20, 30 years. Hmm. Right? So there's a group of ultra rich people, and there's a large population of increasingly impoverished people with a smaller, increasingly smaller middle class in between. Right? So inequality is this thing where we actually don't have the correct imagination of inequality here in the US, especially because of the narratives of the American dream and pulling by the, you know, pulling yourself up by the bootstrap and all those, right? So there's that disconnect as well.
Right. And to kind of tie some things together, I know I'm getting off of the written questions, but when the United States was more of a leader in the global climate movement, we had, correct me if I'm wrong, but we had a bigger middle class. So do you think like a middle class is important in being a leader against climate change?
So that's a very good and a tough question, which I can sort of answer at a conceptual level, right? Because I always sort of think about what kind of evidence I know of about something, you know, and based on which I can, you know, make some arguments. So everything that I've said so far, you know, I know of specific pieces of evidence that I'm thinking of when I'm talking about these questions. But this is a question that actually requires more research and investigation. But I'll answer your question by sort of using a proxy, which is that if you look at income inequality, right? So the greater the income inequality, the smaller the share of real middle class. So if you would, if you have a moving idea of what, you know, because if a country grows more prosperous, its middle class should also grow more prosperous, right? So it's, you can't use a fixed income data for defining the middle class. What used to be middle class in the 1970s, you know, that should be now the income of poor people, for example, right? Because everybody is supposed to be doing better than they used to do before. So the increase in income inequality since, let's say, early 90s has coincided with the failure to address the climate crisis, both at home as well as internationally, right? Mm-hmm. So in that sense, there is certainly a pattern that we see, which is that as certain classes of economic elites have taken control of US politics and economics, it has become much more difficult to do environmental regulations and climate action and so forth. Right? So in that sense, there's definitely a correlation. Now we have to look at how these things actually unfolded to see if there was a causal relationship between the decline of middle class and the particular policies that the economic elites have pursued over time, right? So I can't, you know, say for sure what if that is a causal relationship, but there's definitely a correlation in terms of the coexisting patterns of the decline of middle class and the decline of environmental leadership within the US. The other thing to think about is the density of labor unions. So if when you have a time, take a look at, you know, and this graph is actually quite popular. So you'll find it very easily in on Google Images. If you put in density of labor union, United States, economic inequality, you'll see a graph that shows you that the increase in economic inequality has been perfectly a mirror image of the decline of union density in the US. And again, you know, there needs to be more research on that. I know some conceptual arguments about how that ties into political and policy making, decision making, but one has to do more research on what these changes in our economy and in our society have meant for our ability to address climate crisis and environmental crisis.
course. So thinking about the people who are affected by the climate crisis, when trying to help those communities, what's the difference between, and if you could explain this a little bit, free market solutions proposed by the UN and more grassroots community building with like no strings attached?
Right, so that's a great question. And it actually sort of ties back to when we talked about the relationship between the majority of the world's population that actually subsidizes our lifestyles, right? Mm-hmm. It sort of ties back into that discussion again. So I'll give you an example of a market-based solution. And I'll make, in context of that example, it's useful to sort of actually think about another important issue in the US context and about US exceptionalism. So one market-based solution to climate crisis is these offsets, right? And the offsets are basically projects that will allow you to support, let's say there's an industry and they are supposed to reduce their emissions by a certain level, right? So if they have the option of actually creating offsets, they will, you know, go and talk to some group in Africa or Asia and ask them to grow a forest on a 100 hectares or acres or whatever the unit you think most comfortable in. And there's certain scientific computations we can do about, you know, what a forest of certain age, of certain area and certain kinds of species, how much of greenhouse gases and carbon that forest will absorb, right? So as an industrialist, you can say that I'm supporting this forest in this part of Africa, which is going to absorb an equivalent amount of carbon that is emitted because of my industrial activity. So I should be allowed to, you know, count that as part of my commitment to reduce emissions. Does that make sense, right? So yeah, these are the offset projects. So a more common example of that is to think about when you buy your airline tickets, you get an option to add $5 or $6 to offset the emissions associated with your airline ticket. And so those are the kinds of projects that are supposed to be funded by these offset costs that are paid by either the consumers or by the industrialists and so forth. Now, the problem is that the when you do that, the forest in Africa the hypothetical forest in Africa that I talked about, they will be used as a sort of a carbon manufacturing plant, so as to say, right?
Okay.
Because they're then treated as a factory that sucks in carbon, right? It's a thing that is meant for a particular purpose. And once you do that, then, you know, local people who used to rely on the same land for, you know, for forest foods, medicinal herbs, for some cultural purposes, even some small scale subsistence farming within forest areas, they will all be thrown out of that forest area. Because now this forest has become a cash cow, so as to say. Right? So this is an instance in which the market-based solutions create violation of human rights to food, to water, and so forth. Mm-hmm. Now, what would be an alternative model of the same process, but which wouldn't actually require quote-unquote selling off the forest to the industrialist, right? An alternative model would be that, which was actually proposed in the beginning of the global climate governance, there was this proposal to create a global fund which will come out of the taxes that would be imposed on carbon emitters. And those would be at the national level, but of course every national government will then impose those taxes on the those who are responsible for emissions of carbons, like fossil fuel corporations and so forth. So we could take such a fund, and then we could, you know, channel those funds in supporting the kind of agriculture that is actually good for local populations and is also good for climate change.
Okay.
So agroecological systems of agriculture, they are effective at sequestering carbon in soil, because if you may know that soil is one of the biggest and the most effective places to store carbon. And effective soil management can actually create, can act as a climate mitigation process, But, and the traditional forms of subsistence agriculture goes well with those processes of soil conservation. So you could take these funds from, you know, pollution creating industries and fossil fuel corporations and invest in local communities that are part of a model of agriculture and a lifestyle that is supportive of climate protection initiatives, nature conservation initiatives, and so forth. You can support human development among communities and women's empowerment in communities so that those women will have the power to make their own reproductive choices, right? And so that they will have, so that you don't have to talk about population control as this sort of top-down, you know, sort of almost racist project where we think about poor people producing and causing environmental damage. In the first case, you know, it's not true subject, you know, I mean, factually speaking, it is not true that poor people undermine environmental resources and environmental protection. And second, there is global evidence that the only way you can actually stabilize global population is by promoting women's rights and gender empowerment and economic development more broadly, right? Not in terms of sort of market development, but a kind of development that actually is widely shared and much more equally distributed compared to our current models of development, which are, you know, heavily skewed in favor of a particular strata in global society.
It's very powerful to think about, because it kind of changes the way that we just approach just how we live our lives and how we grow as a society. And I appreciate, but I appreciate that you go into these very complicated issues with the facts. And I asked a question earlier that you weren't really sure on, and so you weren't, you didn't want to say anything that wasn't true. So I do appreciate that.
Of course, I mean, that's, you know, as academics and professors, we are bound by those codes of conduct, right?
So from all this research that you've done, what would you say are the most important takeaways? And if you could boil down any of your research, or maybe if you want to talk about more specifically your most recent book, just like a one easily digestible message, what would that be?
Sure. So, I mean, continuing with our ongoing sort of, you know, the discussions that we have had so far, the most important thing that we can do to prevent or to address climate crisis is to reduce our consumption, right? And reduce our consumption, not just in terms of recycling and, you know, biking and all those kind of stuff, but actually reduce our consumption by refusing to give up on our cell phone as long as it actually doesn't die, right? Refusing to give up on our laptops as long as they don't actually die. And so our consumption is not just about our personal choices. Our consumption is also about institutional policies and protocols that either promote certain kind of consumption or prevent people from actually continuing to use that product. So for example, and I don't mean to be, we are doing a lot of great things here at UConn, but, you know, the way we change our entire computer system every 4 to 5 years, that's actually quite wasteful, right?
And no one thinks about where that waste is going.
Right, exactly. And in fact, I mean, I have this personal example. So the laptop that I'm actually talking with the assistance of right now, it's a laptop that UConn has officially rejected. They wouldn't let me use it on UConn campus because they've refused to sort of, you know, beef up, continue to provide the security upgrades that will allow me to continue to use this laptop. And this is actually has so many nice things, you know, that I love about. But yeah. I was forced to buy a second laptop because, you know, we have certain kinds of policies that, you know, prevent us from getting security updates and so forth. So, and then similarly, you know, if you think about the whole advertising business, right, talking about Mad Men, right, we live in an era that has been created by Mad Men. There ought to be a greater regulation of, you know, the processes of greenwashing. I'm sure all of you have heard about the phrase greenwashing.
Yeah.
It should be criminal for corporations to mislead their consumers. So to sort of in a nutshell, when I talk about, you know, consumption, I don't just mean like personal habits, which we definitely need to change, but we also need to sort of talk about the policies of universities and the departments of federal and state governments and the corporations and all the regulations that affect our consumption in very, very real ways. So that's the first thing that we should all be doing at various levels, and we should be fighting for these kinds of policy changes. The second important thing that comes directly from my research, and here, you know, I can talk about my book from 2017. It's called Democracy in the Woods, published by Oxford University Press. That many a times these discussions of climate and environment, even, you know, when people talk about indigenous people, there's a lot of discussion about the culture of indigenous people and how it's good for environment, and we should all be moving to that culture, right? But just as I explained in the context of the example of being not able to use my laptop any longer, whatever we do vis-a-vis our energy consumption is shaped greatly by politics and policy processes. And this particular fact that politics and policy process is not just a side thing that you can think about once you have actually figured out solutions to climate change. The solutions to climate change will never come about as long as we don't get our politics right.
Right.
So my book actually shows by comparing India, Tanzania, and Mexico, and those arguments actually apply more broadly, but those are the three countries that I studies. I show that you have to have a politics in which different actors, you know, market-based actors, politicians, government policymakers, peasants, indigenous people, when each of these actors have a certain kind of say in how things are run in politics and policymaking, we often actually see policies that work better for the environment. And so having the right kind of politics, and I'm not going into the details of that process, there's an entire sort of, you know, architecture of arguments there, but having the right kind of politics is extremely important to make sure that we are able to address our environmental crisis, climate crisis, and our social crisis, which is the crisis of this, unforgivable, intolerable inequality that we have come to somehow accept as being normal. Even when there's a lot of discussion, you know, if you look at surveys about how many people actually support increased taxes on rich people who make more than 400,000, per annum, even that, there is not a universal consensus on that, right? And so I think we need to have greater conversation on inequality, which is actually the root cause of climate crisis, as we talked about in the beginning of our discussion.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's important that we do things like this so that people know that they need to understand this issue, because they don't even know how we're being oppressed, or how people in other countries are being oppressed by this honestly heartbreaking circumstances that we've come to. But and especially countries like here, where we can actually take the time to call policymakers and get that change, I think that's very important when having right. attention.
Exactly.
And for anyone listening, your book is available on Amazon, I believe. Just yes.
And once again, if you're interested, it's called Democracy in the Woods: Environmental Conservation and Social Justice in India, Tanzania, and Mexico. Or is that the wrong one?
No, that's the right one.
Okay.
can I add another point that I meant to add to my previous discussion? So, you know, the discussion of the carbon, and you said you can edit it, right? So,
yeah.
The discussion of carbon offsets is actually also a really good example to understand U.S. exceptionalism in another context, which is that in our political discourse here, remember, carbon offsets are a leftist idea. Is that right? So think about that. I mean, we know that carbon offsets don't work in most of the settings. So there are, I talked about the research from Global South, which shows how our carbon offsets can create human rights violations in Global South. But there's also research from California, which shows that, when you have market-based carbon emission reduction programs, they work much better for, well-educated majority population communities compared to the poor African-American communities and communities with racial minorities. Because of the, because industries and their pattern of where the dirty manufacturing plants are located, all of that makes sure that poor people still pay the price of cleanup, even when some of our policies are successful, right? And in fact, that has been the whole argument of the environmental justice movement, that the cost of environmental cleanup, as well as environmental risks and hazards, are borne disproportionately by racial minorities. So to come back to this discussion of sort of the ideological polarization here in the US, the success of the right wing has been that it has painted some of the mainstream economic solutions, which are actually right of center solutions. They have painted those solutions as crazy left wing ideas, right? Which is dictionary definition of left wing doesn't match up with any of the discussions that I ever hear here in the context of our politics here. So, the reason I bring up these questions is because, as future leaders, it's really important for all of you to be cognizant of how our particular history has shaped these discussions of climate action and environmental policy. And so understanding these, sort of narratives and discourses that have been promoted by a particular set of actors interested in particular kinds of outcomes is also equally important for us as we are, moving forward, and we want to sort of move to pathways where we can better address some of these problems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. And I think it's an important point to make that UConn-PERG, the organization that is organizing this, we are nonpartisan, but that does not mean that we are apolitical, because it is very important for us to be involved in politics and critique both sides of at least the American system, or maybe even the global system.
Absolutely, yeah.
So, and I think it's important for young leaders like Monet and I, but also other people that we've talked to on this podcast in earlier episodes or in future episodes, for us to think about this in a wider sense,
right.
And and, you know, try to really come up from the grassroots. So our next step is talking about mitigating climate change versus adapting to it, which we'll be talking about next episode with two more UConn environmentalists. Professor Cashman, I want to thank you again for being on here. You have any last points?
You're very welcome. It was a pleasure to talk to both of you, Mone and Ben. And I appreciate what you've been doing. And please let me know if I can be of any assistance in any of your programs. And again, thanks everybody for your engagement. I look forward to hearing from many of you and hopefully seeing some of you in the climate justice class that I teach. I'll be offering it this winter in the winter intercession. And again, next summer. Normally I offer it during the spring semester, but I'm not teaching next spring. So it'll be the spring of 2022 in the regular session.
Awesome. Right, thank you so much, Professor Cashman.
Thank you. It was such a pleasure to talk to both of you.
So this has been the Save the Earth podcast, and thanks for listening, and stay safe, everyone.